Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Fire on the Prairie, the monthly radio show brought to you by In These Times magazine. I'm Aaron Sarber.
And I'm Emily Udell. You can visit Fire on the Prairie on the web at fireontheprairie.com.
In light of the recent AFL-CIO split, this episode focuses on the future of organized labor and the changing nature of work in the United States.
I think the real force of labor in politics and also in organizing is the number of people that it can bring to bear and mobilize, not the amount of money. Labor really has to excite not only its own members, but its potential supporters by representing an alternative vision.
Aaron Sarver talks to In These Times senior editor David Moberg and Jamie Daniel, labor activist and director of organizing and development of the University Professionals of Illinois, Local 4100.
Emily Udell interviews Chicago Public Radio's deputy news director, Ben Calhoun. Calhoun is curating an exhibit of photographs and audio recordings about service industry workers at the Peace Museum in Chicago.
Finally, you'll hear a conversation with Gene Bruskin of the group U.S. Labor Against War. David Moberg is senior editor of In These Times magazine, where he has covered labor issues since 1976. His recent articles, Labor Split a Mixed Bag, and Gods and Mortals, analyze the recent split of the AFL-CIO. Currently, seven unions, including SEIU, the Teamsters, and United Food and Commercial Workers, and their 7 million members, have forged a new coalition called Change to Win. Aaron Sarver recently sat down with Moberg to discuss the future of organized labor.
What are the biggest challenges that both the remaining members of the AFL-CIO and the newly formed Change to Win coalition face?
The challenges remain the same after the split as before the split. The union density or the share of union representation of the workforce has been slowly, steadily declining. The big challenge is to increase those numbers, but not just to increase those numbers randomly. Part of the argument has been over how do you increase numbers in a way that builds strength. Partly you build strength by having effective political operations, but you also have to have strength in industries so that as a union you can adequately represent workers. So part of the debate going into this whole thing had been over how much unions should focus on 1, 2, 3, 4 so-called core industries. I think what comes out of this debate and split is both sides agreeing to a certain degree that they do need to concentrate more, focus on their organizing. Obviously, the challenges go beyond that. That you know, the challenges politically right now with Republicans in control of every branch of government at the national level are extraordinary. First of all, because there's always the threat of some kind of hostile attack. And second of all, there's just very little prospect of anything positive getting through.
Do you think we'll see a lot of raiding from the Change to Win coalition?
Well, the threat, obviously, theoretically, is of raiding from either side. And raiding technically means when one union tries to take away members that belong to a local union, for example, of another national union. There's another kind of conflict that develops. It's not technically called raiding, but there are situations where one union has started organizing a particular group of workers and another union then begins to move in and tries to organize them as well. And that can be a source of great conflict. It certainly was here in Illinois when SEIU was organizing home health care workers that are paid by the state but not directly employed by the state. And AFSCME, the main state public employee worker union, began to try to organize there as well. And that was a bitter conflict just earlier this year that got resolved to some extent because they were both inside the AFL-CIO. Now, the same mechanisms for resolving those disputes won't exist because they aren't both in the AFL-CIO.
Democrats have traditionally relied on labor unions for a large amount of their campaign funds and efforts. What effect will the split have on Democratic candidates?
For one thing, Democratic candidates will now have more places they have to go to ask for money, and there'll be more confusion, perhaps in some cases some kind of conflict over endorsements and support. I think on the whole it's not going to make a huge difference, because this split is not really an ideological split. It's not that one group is more liberal or more to the left than the other, more conservative or to the right. They split really over strategic and tactical issues.
What role do you see labor councils playing under the new structure of the Change to Win coalition?
The labor movement historically has been organized into these individual unions called nationals or internationals, if they happen to have some members in Canada, that were then affiliated to the AFL-CIO. And the AFL-CIO was organized not only nationally, but they had state federations and then what were usually called central labor councils. So the Chicago Federation of Labor, for example, is a central labor council. And these state federations and central labor councils had really fallen into disrepair and become relatively ineffective over the years in most parts of the country. There's been a movement that started before John Sweeney took office 10 years ago, but one that he tried to accelerate to make these central labor councils and state federations into much more effective operations for politics, for building solidarity among unions at the local level, for even playing a role in local economic development issues. In the best of these instances, the councils have really developed strong sense of cooperation among a lot of local unions. These ties are now going to be strained, frayed, or broken, partly because the constitution of the AFL-CIO says that if you don't belong to the national organization, that you can't belong to the local organization. And there were all sorts of discussions during the week among Central Labor Council leaders about how they could get around that prohibition. In some cases, they're talking about setting up a new coalition that would involve both the traditional Central Labor Council and the new breakaway unions. Others were just talking about how, well, we might not be at the same meetings, but they have my telephone number and they know how to reach me, and they're going to try to work together. So that's actually something that, at a very practical level, a lot of people were quite concerned about, that they felt that the split at the national level might end up not being as important or harmful as the split at the local level.
What changes would you like to see organized labor adopt?
I thought that it was not the best idea for the unions to split from the AFL-CIO. I also think that it probably would have been a good idea for Sweeney to have stepped down when he said he was going to at the end of 10 years. Not because I think he's done a bad job, but just because I think that it would have been good to have had a chance to hash out these issues of strategy, with the question of leadership also being open for contention. To some extent, unions need to organize much, much more than they have. They need to be much more focused and strategic in their organizing. But one element that I think has tended to get left out in this debate is the importance of involving existing members and rank-and-file workers who are unorganized in the strategic plans of the labor movement much more. I think the real force of labor in politics and also in organizing is the number of people that it can bring to bear and mobilize, not the amount of money. Labor really has to excite not only its own members, but its potential supporters by representing an alternative vision, a vision of society, of the economy, that's different from what's being offered by either Republicans or by most of the Democrats these days, and to put pressure, particularly on the Democrats, because that's the most likely prospect, of trying to move away from this blind obeisance to the market and to see a new need for trying to create essentially a new deal for the global economy. There's a whole host of smaller things that I think are important, but that kind of emphasis on trying to spark a democratic upsurge and to create a more compelling vision for the future of American society, those are things that I think got short shrift in this sometimes all too technical and structural debate that went on.
You just heard Aaron Sarver speaking with In These Times senior editor David Moberg. Next, Aaron speaks with Jamie Daniel. Daniel is Director of Organizing and Development at UPI Local 4100, a union that represents faculty and staff at public universities in Illinois. Daniel is co-chair of the Chicago Center for Working Class Studies. Her scholarly writing focuses on theories and practices of the public sphere.
What reactions have you heard from rank-and-file members about the AFL-CIO split?
Unfortunately, a lot of rank-and-file members still don't know very much about it. There hasn't been as much consultation with the rank-and-file as I think a lot of people would have been more comfortable with. People are mostly worried about whether there's going to be too much pressure from various layers on top for us to not work together. And generally speaking, I'm happy to say that the people who do know about it are kind of assuming that they're going to continue working together as usual until somebody makes them stop and then make an issue of it. So there's anxiety, but also I think a sense of all these decisions are being made way up there somewhere, but we live here and we need to work here and continue working together here, especially now with, you know, all the assaults of the Bush administration on labor and even local assaults on labor through the Daley administration and so forth. So,
what impact will the split have on labor councils in Chicago?
Well, the main labor council in Chicago is the Chicago Federation of Labor, which represents over 500,000 unionized workers in Cook County. And its great strength has always been its ability to bring together unions and constituencies that otherwise would have a hard time sitting at the same table. All the building trades are represented there, all the very small old craft unions, you know, the heat and frost workers and small unions like that, and the, you know, the big bears, the Teamsters and SEIU and both of the UFCW locals. I think that the pressure, at least as it exists now, from the AFL-CIO, which has told Central Labor Councils, you absolutely under, you know, no conditions may continue working at least in a financial relationship with the disaffiliated unions, is going to be catastrophic. As I understand it, the CFL stands to lose $1.2 million annually in per capita money, and that's money that they have used, you know, very successfully both to help with the city worker contracts. The contracts were out for 2 years before Daley would finally sit down and give people a decent contract. They have a political impact in Springfield that helps everybody in Chicago, which I think will be impacted if they don't have enough money to do their daily work. At the basic ground level, where for the last 10 years or so, a number of organizations, not just Jobs with Justice, but a number around the city have worked very, very hard to build alliances with labor unions that previously had not existed and that previously were somewhat unimaginable given the sort of rigidity of the way that unions used to separate themselves off and try to be as autonomous as possible. I think this is a really vulnerable moment because the Central Labor Councils have been the structure through which everybody can link up to each other.
Do you see any potential positive changes with the proposals put forth from the Change to Win coalition?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's been an emphasis since the mid-90s when John Sweeney was elected on an organizing platform. I think a lot of us are thinking, okay, what does organizing mean if you're going to emphasize organizing? Does it just mean corporate campaigns where without the inclusion of organized workers, you put pressure on an employer to unionize or to pick up the sort of contract that other folks in his or her business are signing on to? Or does it mean getting workers involved, giving workers an active role in what the union is doing, which to my mind is one of the reasons the labor movement is weaker than it has been previously. I've had this experience around Chicago going into unionized workplaces and asking people what union they belong to and they don't know. Or asking them, when was the last time you went to a meeting at the union hall and discussed an issue of importance to your membership other than do you want to ratify this contract or not? And a lot of people haven't even made it to the ratification meetings. So I think there's a real danger in understanding organizing as simply getting folks to sign cards or getting employers to agreeing to sit down and work out a contract without having the member buy-in. And I think for a lot of us, the level or the extent to which a lot of the decisions that have been made in the last couple months have been made without a very large degree of member discussion or even member awareness is quite troubling.
What changes would you like to see labor unions adopt?
I think the greatest challenge now is going to be for all of us to not be distracted by this, you know, War of the Titans kind of situation in which there's a lot of, I think, unnecessarily nasty rhetoric and oversimplified rhetoric about, you know, who's been doing the work they should be doing, who hasn't. Everybody's been working very hard to try to figure out the way to help people enjoy the rights that they should have on the job. And we're up against more opposition from employers and from the government than we have been, I think, at any point in the past. And so what I hope is that local bodies will figure out ways to keep the good relationships that are there intact and work around the bureaucratic or institutional differences so that rank and file folks and folks who need to be organized don't suffer in the process.
You're listening to Fire on the Prairie. You just heard Aaron Sarver talking with David Moberg and Jamie Daniel about the breakup of the AFL-CIO.
U.S. Labor Against War is an organization of unions and individuals that are fighting for an anti-war agenda within the labor movement. Emily Udell caught up with USLAW leader Gene Bruskin at the International Labor Communicators Association conference in Chicago.
Can you tell me why war is an issue for the labor movement?
Well, war is an issue for the labor movement for the same reason, and in many ways more, than it is for everybody in this country. It's drained our treasury. It's literally, it's hard to imagine, but the war is costing $200 million every day at a point in time when we're cutting Medicaid, we can't provide health insurance, and when we're cutting affordable housing budgets and so on. People are dying, and the people who die are not the children of Congress people or the upper middle class. They're poor and working people, you know, and that's who's in the labor movement, and our families are in the National Guard and the Reserve. And importantly, politically, the war has served as an anchor for President Bush's entire anti-worker, anti-people agenda. He has folded it into this war against terrorism, and he justifies virtually everything he does, from budget cuts to pumping up unnecessary amounts in the Pentagon budget to taking away workers' rights in the federal government based on this war and the link to the war on terrorism. So it's his stalking horse, and without challenging him on the war, we cannot really challenge the rest of his agenda, which is very destructive.
And how do you go about bringing people from the labor movement into the fold, like unions or individuals? How do you go about generating that support for what you're doing?
Well, I mean, at this point, there is a network of 125 organizations that are part of U.S. Labor Against the War that are in that are everywhere from Chicago to Immokalee, Florida, where the Immokalee workers are part of it, to New York City and Vermont and all over the country. People can be active through their central labor councils and state federations. You can be a member of U.S. Labor Against the War as an individual and talk to your fellow members and get information. We have a website, www.uslaboragainstwar.org, that has tons of information on it, including a lot of information about the Iraqi labor movement. Which is a hugely untold story, that Iraq has a labor movement, that it is vibrant, that it's a very courageous people. We just took them on a national tour of 25 cities in this country to give people a chance to actually talk to and hear from an Iraqi. And these Iraqis told everybody that they talked to that the occupation is the problem. Bring the troops home.
Tell me about something about your long-term strategy for moving forward with the resolutions that you've set out.
You mean beyond this convention? Well, I think we have every intention of continuing to make foreign policy a local issue, and it's not a remote issue. It's not a Washington, D.C. issue. It's an issue that every worker needs to be concerned about, because how we conduct ourselves in the rest of the world has a huge impact on trade, on our credibility as a nation, and on all the social and economic things that workers care about. So we intend to continue to agitate about this and organize around it, and to call for the labor movement to take up foreign policy, crucial foreign policy issues in their unions, and make sure that workers' voices are heard.
Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot.
That was an interview with Gene Bruskin of U.S. Labor Against War. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that more than 80% of Americans will work in the service industry by the year 2012. Chicago Public Radio's Deputy News Director Ben Calhoun decided to pair audio producers with photographers to document the experiences of men and women in the expanding service workforce. The result is an audiovisual exhibit called Daily Meaning, Life Inside America's Service Industries. The show captures the stories of a hotel housekeeper, a dog groomer, a real estate agent, and many more. Emily Dell recently chatted with Calhoun about the exhibit, which opens at Chicago's Peace Museum on September 2nd.
How did you define jobs in the service industry for your project?
It was actually a rough definition. The way we defined it in the end was something along the lines of people who work in service industries don't, you know, according to the technical definition, don't manufacture, build, or construct anything. But more specifically, we fine-tune that as people who do something that other people are either not willing or not capable of doing. So, you know, you hire a real estate agent because you don't know how to navigate all the legalities of buying your house. As the pet groomer, Nick Rice, in his audio portrait, he says, what am I doing for a living? I'm doing something that you don't want to do. It's a messy job. I remember he was the first interview I did, and it just rang in my head for months, because it was exactly what we had, as a group, kind of decided was going to define this group of people that we tried to tell their stories.
What were some of the challenges that you and the photographers and producers you worked with faced in doing this project?
Well, there were lots of kind of mundane challenges. I mean, navigating corporate personnel was not easy. I mean, our pet groomer was employed by PetSmart, so we had to go through Arizona, the corporate offices in Arizona, and, you know, get that okayed. But I think the more interesting challenges were all kind of related to trying to give a complete picture of people in such a short, small amount of work. You know, you've got 10 photographs at the most, you know, maybe just 2 photographs, and you want to give a complete emotional sense of what it's like to inhabit the space that is this job. You know, you've got 7 minutes of audio. How do you convey, you know, years of human experience in 7 minutes? I mean, that was the real challenge of, I think, what we were trying to do.
What do you think is unique about telling stories about work?
You know, the workplace is such a complex intersection of all of these cultural, political forces, you know, class and gender and you know, money and power, and all of these things are coursing through everybody's workplace. But I think because we spend so much time at work, it becomes part of the everyday experience. We underestimate how much is actually taking place there, and how much our experience in that niche in society kind of says about the rest of the world, like all of these, you know, the rest of the world that it kind of rubs up against in these different moments and through serving customers and through, you know, serving other industries. I think that that hearing people tell stories from those unique perspectives, you know, is really a window into all those things.
Let's listen to a clip.
Well, the sample that people are going to hear is, this is JK, Jeffrey Kuhn. He's a bike messenger for Velocity Messenger Service in Chicago. He used to work in a tattoo shop, and then he decided that he wanted a job where he could get in shape. So he became a bike messenger in, I think it was 2001. I hope I got that right. 2001, and he's still doing it. So this is a section, it's one of my favorite sections because he's talking about his relationship to the city that he works in every day.
When you're a bike messenger, and this is one reason I think guys, you feel like you have a little more right to the streets. You sort of snap at cars a little more because of this. When you're down there, you're on the streets. You, when it's cold, you're cold. If it rains, you get wet. If it's windy, you get knocked over. If it's hot, you're sweating. Like, you're in the city with the city. The exhaust of other cars goes onto you. You know, leaves and bugs, stuff flying around goes onto you. You know, you're dirty at the end of the day with the grit of the city. So you end up with this real connection to the city.
What stands out for you about this clip?
Well, I think it goes back to kind of what I feel like the point of the show is at this point. Not that this was always, you know, crystallized from the beginning, but I feel like what we were able to really accomplish was to let people tell their stories in a way that gave kind of a complete emotional sense of what it's like to be in their job and their shoes. What it's like to kind of look at the world through their job, you know, emotionally, this very human experience. I remember when I first heard him say that when we were doing the interview, and I got goosebumps on my arms because I felt like it was the kind of moment where somebody is telling a story and you can completely get a sense of what it was like to experience it.
What do you hope the audience of this show comes away from it with?
The best thing people could take away from the show is two things. How diverse the human experiences are that are making up this transition to a service economy. So, you know, you could make $500,000 a year and be part of that transition. You could be a recent immigrant working for $6 an hour and be part of that transition. You could not see anybody all day and be part of that transition. You know, you could process data. You could be somebody who deals with people on like a constant basis and be part of that transition. So I think the diversity of human experiences that are part of the transition to the service economy is one thing that I hope they get a sense of. But then also the common elements that are defining that transition in terms of human experience.
That was Emily Udell speaking with Ben Calhoun, curator of Daily Meaning, Life Inside America's Service Industry. The exhibit opens on September 2nd at the Peace Museum in Chicago.
Thanks for listening to this month's edition of Fire on the Prairie, the radio show sponsored by In These Times magazine.
You can listen to past shows online and subscribe to our podcast at fireontheprairie.com. You can also visit In These Times magazine at inthesetimes.com.
This show was produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next month.